From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the Detroit News endorses Gary Johnson for president.
I think we surprised quite a few people with our endorsement today.
Even as the conservative Cincinnati Inquirer breaks a long tradition to endorse Hillary Clinton.
It's not a lesser of two evils editorial, but at the end of the day, it was who's the better person to lead, and that's where we ended up.
The U.S. House says yes to money for Flint's water crisis.
Believe me, I would have loved to have seen it earlier. I had introduced legislation back in April and wanted to see this resolved much quicker.
And a new book digs into the business side of Motown.
These were the people behind the company who helped build that business, without whom it wouldn't have been a business, it wouldn't have been a viable company.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The Detroit News today broke its 143-year tradition of endorsing the Republican candidate for president. The news endorsement goes to Libertarian candidate Gary Johnson. Here with us now, Ingrid Jacques, Detroit News Deputy Editorial Page Editor. Ingrid, why Gary Johnson? Walk us through your reasoning.
Okay, well, I think we surprised quite a few people with our endorsement today, but I mean, basically, we were given a field of candidates that made this choice something we saw as our only option. Donald Trump on the Republican side, Hillary Clinton on the Democratic side. Both candidates we weighed very carefully, and we found them both wanting in numerous ways. And we decided, as we say in our endorsement, to make this an endorsement of conscience, of backing an individual we think that has a solid background, two-term governor of New Mexico, and we think he's in of the three. We think he's probably the most honorable of them, and we feel most comfortable putting our support behind him.
What is it about Gary Johnson's policies, Ingrid, that made you believe that he is the most qualified? And specifically, what do you think Gary Johnson offers to Michigan?
It's a good question. I mean, as a whole, we tend to be fairly, I mean, we're a conservative editorial board, and we have quite a few libertarian leanings, and Gary Johnson aligns with a lot of the values that we hold. I think where he lacks the most and is quite well known is in his knowledge or lack thereof of foreign policy. And that is something when he visited with us 2 weeks ago, we talked to him for about an hour, and we really grilled him on his stance on foreign policy. And he, for the most part, he gave us pretty good answers. And we felt confident enough that if he were in the office, he would do the job well. And he would honor, you know, current agreements with other nations. He said he'd support NATO. So he assuaged most of our fears in that regard.
I do have to ask you, on the very day that you're probably putting the final touches on
right.
this endorsement, let's just take a quick listen as he's on MSNBC with host Chris Matthews.
Canada, Mexico, Europe over there, Asia, South America, Africa, name a foreign leader that you respect.
I guess I'm having an Aleppo moment in the former president of Mexico.
But I'm giving you the whole world.
I know.
Anybody in the world you like. Anybody. Pick any leader.
The former president of Mexico.
Which one?
I'm having a brain.
Did that give you pause, Ingrid? Were there any, like, second thoughts?
Well, our papers had already gone to print. So, I mean, but, yeah, we wish that wouldn't have happened. Trust me, it's bad timing. But
I mean, leader of the free world.
Right, but would Donald Trump be any better? I mean, we think he would be dangerous, as we say. He's so unpredictable, and I think he would be worse news for the United States. And I mean, when you look at domestic policy, Johnson has a very solid record. I mean, he created a good job environment in New Mexico. He's got a good stance on education. And he's very socially moderate as well. So there, that should appeal to a wide variety of voters.
Now, I'm looking at the Detroit News editorial of August 8th. So I'm reading it now following Donald Trump's speech to the Detroit Economic Club. And the headline is, Trump in Detroit offers solid economic plan, a heartening success to his GOP supporters. Its delivery provides Trump with a map for bringing a derailed presidential campaign back on track. That was just 7 weeks ago. Ingrid, what changed?
Well, pretty much everything else that Trump says. I mean, I think we saw him, just in the debate earlier this week. I mean, he's a bully. He's rude. He's not presidential. And, I mean, we stand by what we said in our editorial today. And we've consistently been critical of him in our pages.
In 2004, the news chose to sit it out, not endorsing George W. Bush or John Kerry.
Right.
Was that a consideration this time around?
Yeah, of course. But it's only something that this paper has done three times in its history, as you know, 143 years, mm-hmm. twice during the Franklin Roosevelt administration and then in 2004. But this time around, we thought it would be better to be proactive, to support a candidate, as we call it. It's a conscience vote, conscience endorsement. We stand by it, and we think of the choices that we were given. We did not pick those three or, you know, ever assume that Donald Trump would be the Republican nominee, but he is. So this is what we're faced with, and in light of that, Gary Johnson was the best choice for us.
Well, we're a few hours into when the paper got online and people opened it up to read this endorsement. What kind of reaction have you gotten? What kind of backlash have you gotten?
No, some good, some bad. I mean, it definitely was a surprising endorsement to a lot of our readers. But we hope that, I mean, they'll read it carefully and, you know, try to understand where we were coming from here. We tried to lay it out in great detail why we couldn't back Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton.
Detroit News Deputy Editorial Page Editor Ingrid Jacques. Ingrid, thanks so much for speaking with us today on Stateside.
Thank you.
Another of the conservative-leaning newspapers that broke a long tradition of endorsing Republican presidential candidates is the Cincinnati Enquirer. That moment came September 21st with an editorial titled, It Has to Be Hillary Clinton. Peter Bhatia is the editor of the Cincinnati Enquirer, and he is with us now. Peter, walk us through why the Enquirer endorsed Hillary Clinton.
Sure, and it's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you. Our editorial board, which is made up of five people from diverse backgrounds and experiences, spent a lot of time talking through the issues, looking at what was being written and said by the candidates, taking a significant amount of time to think about who, in our judgment, would be the best president. After much deliberation, it turned out to be a consensus of all five of us. We didn't take a vote or anything like that. All five of us independently came to the conclusion that the right choice was Hillary Clinton.
That must have been kind of a moment. Suddenly, it's like the jury verdict, where suddenly you go around and everybody's voting the same. They're on the same page.
I mean, it's probably not as dramatic as some of the jury scenes in movies and things like that. But, we all know each other pretty well, and we all spent plenty of time thinking about it. We'd written some editorials earlier about Mr. Trump's behavior. So I don't think any of us were surprised we ended up there. The fact that we obviously are the editorial board of the Enquirer, which hadn't endorsed a Democrat since Woodrow Wilson, was a bit of a strange place to be. But again, in the end, we felt it was the right thing to do.
And what about the reaction, particularly among your subscribers? Was there backlash?
Oh, yes. It's interesting because I've probably answered close to 150 emails and talked to people on the phone, met with some people in person, met with a reader this morning who was very upset about the endorsement. Many have canceled. You know, I'd like to say that everyone I've talked to had clearly read the editorial. I don't think they did in many cases, because the editorial talked about Secretary Clinton's weaknesses, too, as well as Mr. Trump's weaknesses. And it's not a lesser of two evils editorial, but at the end of the day, it was who's the better person to lead, and that's where we ended up.
Well, I've got to wonder, do you think, as you kind of look at how it reads and what you're hearing from people, was this endorsement more about being for Hillary Clinton or more about being against Donald Trump?
I think that's a yes to both to both parts of it. Mr. Trump has said some pretty outrageous things, obviously, and continues to do so this week. The debate wasn't kind to him in most people's eyes. Yet there are a lot of people out there who believe that Hillary Clinton is a criminal and should be in jail. And I get a pretty steady stream of all the conspiracy theories around the Clintons, you know, up to and including they murdered Vince Foster and things like that.
Right.
It's pretty wild. But I have to tell you, there's a very deeply held and consistent strain among a lot of these people who are upset by our endorsement. Ultimately, you know, as we said in the editorial, who's the best to govern? Who's the best to lead the country for the next 4 years? These are the choices we have, and that's how we ended up with Clinton.
Yeah, as you wrote in the editorial, our reservations about Clinton pale in comparison to our fears about Trump. Now, today the Detroit News endorsed Libertarian Gary Johnson. What did you think when you heard that?
You know, the editors of both papers in Detroit's friends of mine, so I was really interested in calling him up and having a conversation. But, you know, I think every place has to do what they believe to be the right decision. Editorials are editorials. Endorsements are endorsements. And I myself said in a column that the original purpose or the effectiveness of endorsements has faded over time because there's so many more sources of information now. I mean, information comes at us like we're drinking from a fire hose, as the old saying goes, and there's no shortage of places to get information. So, and I tell the readers that are upset, our endorsement is a recommendation. It's our view, and it's something we've done for 100 years. A lot of the criticism is, who do you think you are to endorse? And I said, well, it's fine if you disagree with our endorsement, but it's part of our civic duty to endorse, and we've done it for 100 years. We talked about Mr. Johnson, but ultimately decided that, you know, A, he wasn't a viable candidate, and B, he wasn't endorsable anyway, because when we were having our discussions, it was right after his little Aleppo problem. But, again, in the end, we made the decision we thought was the best one.
Peter Battia, the editor of the Cincinnati Enquirer, which broke a nearly century-old tradition of endorsing GOP presidential candidates, giving its endorsement to Hillary Clinton. Peter, thank you so much for speaking with us on Stateside. It was great to talk with you.
Great to talk with you, too. Thank you very much.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Creation.
Part of the community. The next idea.
It doesn't always look like the dots connect, but they do.
The moon landing. Computers, organ transplants. These were some of the truly transformational innovations from the last half of the 20th century. While there are no doubt brilliant minds from Silicon Valley to Boston working on great new inventions, our next idea partner, Jeff DeGraff, thinks something is missing with this generation of innovators.
Recently, a bright young colleague of mine alerted me to a meeting of the minds at a top technology institution. The event was to be a discussion of the breakthrough research and innovative ideas that are flying under the radar. So I joined the online conference just in time to hear a web feed of CIA computer analyst turned whistleblower Edward Snowden. He was giving a rather unremarkable accounting of the authoritarian state of things here in the land of the free. It wasn't that what he said wasn't true. It was just that it's been true since the onset of the Cold War. In fact, for the most part, it's true everywhere in the developed world. Given the omnipresent internet and that candy bar-sized supercomputer in your pocket that lets your service provider connect you to everyone and everything, you'd have to be disarmingly naive to believe otherwise. It's the old hub-and-spoke system run amok. Forget Big Brother. Your credit card company, cyber crooks, and a whole host of peddlers and illusionists know exactly where you are and what you're doing. It sucks, but it's the bargain you made to participate in the complexity of the modern world. And our legal system and law enforcement agencies lack the resources and capabilities to untangle this all-encompassing web. At this conference, I watched a host of brilliant and brave young speakers present dazzling solutions for circumnavigating the stultifying and oppressive tactics of large-scale institutions, governments, corporations, and ideologically based organizations. And yes, even universities. There's a real irony in the fact that the very institutions that brought my generation together are now the ones keeping us apart. But what I found alarming was the conspicuous absence of the idea of progress in the presentations. The conference seemed to be focused only on making things not happen. It was all about fighting pervasive surveillance, intellectual property laws, and the incestuous relationship between corporate and military interests and the media. Perhaps I missed the point of this forum. Maybe it was just a gathering to socialize a litany of complaints against powerful forces, or something darker, such as a global conspiracy. Either way, this was a reactionary response to reactionary forces. If this conference was any indication, the greater conversation has shifted from a way to move forward together to a way to move apart from each other. And that direction locks us in a static state of the present, each playing defense to the other's offense. For good or evil, large-scale innovations can create a shared sense of destiny in communities and cultures. Massive civil engineering projects, fashions like the shoes and haircut stylings of rock and roll, and impossible moon launches. Railing against the machine with no substitute for the common cause replaces the collective us with the triumphant me. While they desire different ends, the means by which they pursue them are the same for both the righteous revolutionaries and the stalwart incumbents. Where is the sense of destiny? What's the moon launch for this new generation of brilliant and capable young people? We could fix the environment we wrecked, cure the big diseases we couldn't, make education equitable and affordable in ways we didn't. While the days of epic aspirations may be best left in the past, it will take more than tiny houses, small cars, and a modicum of ambition to create what must be created now. Sometimes the best way to fight the man is simply to ignore him altogether and to move on to something better and new. Innovation is the only way forward to the future.
Jeff DeGraff is an expert on innovation from the University of Michigan's Ross School of Business and our partner on The Next Idea.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
We've heard many stories about Motown through the years. You've heard stories of its stars or the story of the ambitious Berry Gordy Jr. using an $800 family loan to build one of the most impactful record labels anywhere. But there's a side to this story that we haven't heard much about until now, the business side, the entrepreneurial spirit, the hustle to get the records played and the company paid. That's the story told in a stunning new book called Motown, The Sound of Young America. It's co-authored by Adam White and Berry Gordy's right-hand man, Barney Ailes. Music journalist Adam White was editor-in-chief of Billboard. He's written for Rolling Stone, Radio and Records, The Times, and many, many more publications. Adam, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And we welcome a legendary name in Motown history, Berry Gordy's right-hand man, Barney Ailes, the Detroiter who led Motown's sales team and from 1975 to 78 was president of Motown. Barney Ailes, such a pleasure to have you with us on Stateside.
Thank you very much. Nice talking to you.
This is a truly spectacular book, both the history you tell us, but the unbelievable photos of the people and the artists who made Motown what it is. And I know a lot of these no one's ever seen before. Adam, what was your goal for this book and the story that you really wanted to get out there?
Well, the goal really was to tell, as you mentioned earlier, the stories that haven't been told. I call them the backroom believers. Barney was the king of the backroom believers. These were the people behind the company who helped build that business, without whom it wouldn't have been a business, it wouldn't have been a viable company. And I think, you know, there have been many books written about Motown. I can say this because I've got them all. And I know, you know, the artists have written their autobiographies. Many stories have been told, but not these stories. And that's what both Barney and I wanted to do, was to add to the sum of knowledge of Motown, to allow people to understand how it was as a business and how it evolved and how it changed people's lives, both the people who work there and the people who listen to the music. So that and the power of the images, because music is always first, but you can never forget with those Motown stars, the imagery, the how they look, just the style, the class, the sparkle, which made a difference, made everything. And that's what we tried to capture in the book, too.
Well, it's amazing, Adam, you comment in the book how good Barney's recollection was of everything.
And that was the goal, really. I mean, for me, the beauty of being able to ask Barney, who was right at the center of gravity, every question as a Motown fanboy I ever wanted to ask. And because I had an aunt who lived in the U.S. when I was in England, who could send me copies of Billboard, for example, the trade magazine, and I would get to see there was another world to this company and to this business. And that's what drew me in. So when I had the opportunity really to sort of interrogate Barney and ask him all of those questions, who were these people? Who were the promotion guys? Who were the distributors? What was it like? How hard was it? How was it like getting paid? What made a difference? Who were the people who really influenced things? And that, for me, was wonderful. And I hope and think for Barney, you felt the same, because it was kind of like you got to tell me about all these people you knew, who mostly nobody really knew anything about, but were absolutely vital to the story and the evolution of the business.
Barney, you accepted Berry Gordy's offer to join Motown really early on, 1961. Why was that? What was it about Berry Gordy that made you go, yep, I'm joining up?
Well, actually, I had a distributorship in Detroit with another gentleman by the name of Harvey Kahn, Henry Droese, and Johnny Kaplan. I met Berry at a radio station and knew nothing about his background, and we just started talking, and then he invited me to go over to the studio, and I went by there, and we just became kind of close friends before I joined him. Then was a problem of worrying about whether our friendship was going to go. You know, it's very hard to work with somebody. So then I said, well, let me think about it. I talked to my wife, and I decided that this would be the time to go. A lot of people don't realize is Barry's background of being a writer with Jackie Wilson and before and stuff like that, and the background that I had with before the distributorship, which had a bunch of labels prior to being with Warner Brothers, that I was a branch manager of Warner Brothers Records when they came out by themselves. And before that, I was with Capitol Records and from 55 on. So it just didn't happen overnight. I mean, there's a background of knowing the music business and what to look for and what to do.
And Cynthia, that was absolutely critical to the success of Motown at that point, because Barney had those relationships, you know, with those people from his time at Capitol and Warner's and his time at Aurora, that gave him the connections and the contacts to help Motown build the business at a critical time. And so there he is, you know, he drops names like Henry Droese and Johnny Kaplan and Harvey Kahn. Those were people whose names I kind of like, who are these guys? And I knew they were vital to the Detroit music business. But when you have an opportunity to understand the roles they played and their relationship with Barney and how that all fell into place to really put fuel into Motown's tank in a business sense, that was absolutely critical.
And understanding as we read the book and get the sense of history, and certainly there's no escaping the issue of race and telling the story of Motown. In fact, you open the book with the 1967 Detroit riots. Barney, your Sicilian background, the sales team you led at Motown was white. Is that, and the connections you had, is that what it took in the early 60s to open the proverbial doors of the industry to Berry Gordy and Motown?
I think it was more the idea of knowing how to work with distributors and radio stations. I mean, the background of collecting the money was the point of being Sicilian. That people weren't never too sure what my connections were with whatever you want to call the organization, mob, Cosa Nostra, stuff like that.
Right.
And I never would tell people one way or the other what the connection was. But I started in the record business at Capitol Records in 55 because I wanted to get married at that time and I needed a job, because prior to that I was with my godfather in construction. Mm-hmm. But the main point, what I was trying to bring out, was that I started in the back room as a stock boy at 75 cents an hour. And so, and they told me, well, that's the way you'd move up into Capitol Records, which I did eventually. I became, besides assistant branch manager, I became one of the main salesmen. They're working myself up to that, and also a promotion manager in the Capitol at Detroit and the area.
So there you are, Cynthia. There was an Italian-American guy. Before he joined the music business, he was good with cement.
You know, Adam, you share with us in the book an anecdote about Barry and Barney going to dinner at Detroit's London Chop House. Will you recap that for us and what that said to you about that time in history and these two men?
Well, it was a pretty extraordinary story. And I guess, you know, they, as Barney's explained, you know, they were friends, their wives were friends, they had a great personal relationship. So the four of them go off to dinner at the Chop House, and Barney, I know you knew the owner, but he wasn't there that night. So the woman at the desk, when the four of you showed up, two white, two black, and she said, you know, I'm sorry, we don't serve colored people. And Barney shot back, that's good, we don't eat them. And, you know, it's like a music hall line, except that it's not funny.
Yeah.
No. Yeah, it wasn't funny at the time. It was scary.
I bet. You were there.
Yeah, I was quite embarrassed. And because I knew the owner of the Chop House, and I used to go there quite a bit, I didn't think there would be a problem whatsoever. Then I saw the look on their face, and it's when I heard her say, well, we don't serve colored people. I became very Sicilian.
You went Sicilian on her, ma'am.
And again, you can't believe that people would say stuff like that, but it just reveals much about the times.
Well, it's fascinating to me, and you know, listening to your accent, Adam, we know where you grew up. How important for Motown was the fact that the label was and is so hugely popular in England? I know that Martha Reeves told me when I interviewed her in the 90s how she always got a huge, huge welcome going to England, still does. We have relatives coming next week from London to visit Detroit for the first time. What do you want to see? Hitsville. That's tops. Why is that, you think? Why that connection?
Well, I mean, first of all, the power of the music. The music was extraordinary, no matter by any standard. But in Britain particularly, it carried extra weight because there was nothing like it locally. I mean, I joke that when I was growing up, look, the first Motown record I heard, and it changed my life, was Heatwave by Martha and the Vandellas. And I'd never heard anything like it. Now, if I turn on the radio at that time at home, you know, I could hear the Beatles. Or I turn on my TV set, I could see the Rolling Stones. I could care less. You know, they were too accessible. It was too obvious. There was this other thing. What was this music coming from Detroit? Where the hell is Detroit? What is Detroit? What is Motown? And I think for a lot of kids my age, that was something. It was the romance of the distant. So it had an extra cachet. It had something, as well as the power of the music. I mean, you're listening to Heatwave or Can I Get a Witness by Marvin Gaye or music like that. And it really was unlike anything else you could hear. And it clearly affected the Beatles. I mean, the Beatles covered three Motown songs on an early album. So I think there was that devotion to the music that was coupled by the exotic nature of where it came from. And then it started to embed itself into British popular culture. But the interesting thing was that the tour of 1965, when the Motown package tour came over, was not a hit. Even though the Supremes had a couple of hit records at that time in the UK, nobody knew who these other artists were. Nobody knew who Stevie was or Martha or the Miracles. So the tour was not a commercial success. But within a year, the music had started to take root and build up a following. And so in a way, Britain was late, but then it became more loyal. The love went deeper. And look, some of the artists found more success in Britain. Jimmy Ruffin, for example.
Yes. Well, it was stunning to me as I read your book, Motown, The Sound of Young America, that comment, you quote Mary Wilson, the impact that it had being in Britain on the Motown artist. And she said, in England, treated like royalty while at home, we weren't black, we were Negroes.
The one thing, a wonderful thing, was connections that I had with EMI, who was very influential in building the label throughout all of Europe. They used to have parties at EMI House with a lot of those pictures where they came from and stuff like that. The idea of sending the groups and all the artists to England on that tour was the same thing that we did in America. Where I got the idea was of sending them across the country and teaching them is when I was at Warner Brothers. Warner Brothers had a television station. They had all the kooky Sunset Strip.
Ed Burns, yes.
Yeah, right. And they sent them around the country promoting ABC and all the shows on Warner Brothers. And then Barry and I sat, and I said, you know, what a great idea if we send the people around. It's going to help me as far as the distributors and radio stations are concerned when they see exactly how great we are. And that's what we did, the same thing in England. And Adam's completely right. It wasn't a winner at the beginning, but it sure became afterwards.
And here's the thing. The relationship that you, Barney, had with EMI and all the international EMI people around Europe also played a role in this book, in that EMI has this fabulous archive of pictures. They kept a proper archive of all of their stuff, paperwork as well as photos, so that when it came to researching and putting this book together, because it was you know, authorized and approved by Universal Music, which now owns the Motown catalog, we got into the Hayes Library and we got those pictures. And they're some of the ones that have never been seen before. And again, it just shows how international that company was, its impact was. But the source of some of those images was from outside the U.S., and they speak volumes, too.
They're amazing. Well, for anybody who ever felt that wonderful chill down their backbone at the first note of any Motown song, this book is an absolute must. It is Motown, The Sound of Young America, co-authored by music journalist Adam White and Berry Gordy's right-hand man, Barney Ailes, the fellow that turned that chemistry of Studio A into the color of money. It was fabulous to meet both of you. I'm sure that those 18 months of Skype calls were fascinating. You made us feel like we were in on it with you. Thank you very much, Barney and Adam, for speaking with us on Stateside.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. You're very welcome.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It has been over a year now since the water crisis in Flint became international news. On Wednesday, the U.S. House approved $170 million towards replacing lead water pipelines in Flint. This Flint funding amendment to the Water Resources Development Act was co-sponsored by Democratic Congressman Dan Kildee of Flint and my guest, Republican Congressman John Molinar of Midland. Congressman, welcome.
Well, thanks so much, Cynthia.
Did you think it would take over a year to get these federal dollars to Flint to address the water crisis?
Well, the legislative process is very slow, and I understand the frustration that the people of Flint have had with the timing of this. And believe me, I would have loved to have seen it earlier. I had introduced legislation back in April and wanted to see this resolved much quicker. But it is great news that we were able to work in a bipartisan way, working with our Michigan delegation to put $170 million into the Water Resources Development Act. And that is a very positive step forward for Flint.
And I know there had to be kind of some digging in, and it actually took the threat of a government shutdown this Friday to get this vote done. What were you hearing, Congressman, from your Republican colleagues as to what their reservations were with money for Flint?
Well, over 100 of our Republican House members did vote for the amendment, which I thought was very significant and again, a very bipartisan approach. The concern people raised was whether infrastructure like this would be a state and local responsibility or what the role of the federal government should be. And so I made the case, as well as others in our delegation, Dan Kildee and others, about the importance of the federal government stepping up because the EPA really dropped the ball on this. They knew almost a year before everyone else did that there were problems, that there were tests that were being done that weren't accurately done, additives weren't being added to prevent the corrosion. So there were significant problems with the federal government's approach, and in my judgment, we had a responsibility for a federal funding to make things right.
Do you think ultimately you were able to get those who were unsure to kind of get that point of view? I guess I'm wondering what ultimately changed minds.
You know, in Congress, it always helps to have a deadline to encourage action. And so we were up at a deadline with both the Water Resources Development Bill as well as the continuing resolution to continue to fund the government through December 9th. And so that forced the action. It forced constructive negotiations and discussions between the House, the Senate, and the executive branch. And I think everything came together in a very positive way for a win-win for Michigan as well as the people of Flint.
Congressman, now we know the differences between the House and Senate versions of the Water Resources Development Bill need to be ironed out. Do you feel like this will happen? Any concerns that this could fall through?
Well, in the legislative process, there's always risk, but I am confident because in the Senate version, the chairman of the Senate committee, Senator Inhofe, as well as the Senate Majority Leader have both expressed their support for helping Flint, and the bill passed in the Senate 95-3. And in the House, we are hoping that Representative Fred Upton, who chairs the Energy and Commerce Committee, will be part of the conference committee that will work between the House and the Senate to get this done. So I'm optimistic, and I think it will get done. My hope is sooner rather than later, but they have to work out a number of differences between the two bills, and that'll happen over the next month.
I'm speaking with Republican Congressman John Molinar of Midland as we talk about the fact that the U.S. House has approved $170 million towards responding to the public health crisis in Flint. And looking at that money, that $170 million, Congressman, can you tell us how does the money get to Flint? Are there any restrictions? What's it to be used for?
Well, it's going to be used for the underground infrastructure, the water pipes that need to be repaired. And in fact, I know you and Steve Carmody have noted a recent University of Michigan study that have shown the significant problem that we have with drinking water service lines in Flint is much greater than we originally anticipated. So this,
yeah, nearly double the number of lead lines than originally thought.
So the timing of this couldn't be better, and the importance of why this is necessary is very much emphasized by this University of Michigan study, which you've talked about. And so I think that's our goal, to get this done as soon as possible. And, you know, it's unacceptable that the people of Flint have endured this time frame without having drinking water. And I've had a chance to visit Flint, talk with families, meet the people who have been affected by this, and they have been tremendous advocates for their community and their children's health, and I'm excited that we're able to make this progress together.
Kind of jumping off that, Congressman, you know, as you've seen, and you know, we have children who are lead poisoned, families that are still having to rely on bottled water, and this has been politicized at the highest levels of our government. So as a member of Congress, if you've watched this unfold, what for you is the broader takeaway as to how our government works to help people in need in this country? What have you learned in this past year?
First of all, I think it's important that people are exposed to, you know, those who are suffering. And so I think it was great that so many members of Congress, as well as presidential candidates, the president and others, visited Flint and talked with the families. And some of the families came out to Washington, D.C. and met with us. And we talked about the nutrition needs. And you had some tremendous advocates, you know, from the researcher and Dr. Mona and others who really help people understand this. And then it gets to a question of Flint is a situation that, you know, was caused, it was a disaster on epic proportions, but it was also a government disaster of all levels of government. And so, you know, we kind of learned how we need to improve the communications between the federal and state and local and make sure that rules are implemented appropriately with accountability. And so I think there were a lot of lessons, but, you know, at the end of the day, I think people want to do what's right and want to help those who are suffering, and we need to make sure that there's not just excessive finger-pointing, but actually concrete efforts to get the job done, and I think we were successful in doing that.
One of the lessons that we've certainly heard loud and clear from Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha is that this is the problem that is going to be going on for years and years. So do you feel it's possible that you're going to have to go back to Congress for more money and more help, and will there be an openness to that?
Well, I think, you know, we're going to have to, you know, monitor the health of the people affected by this. I know there have already been efforts to expand Medicaid services and health coverage for people who have been affected by this. We want to do something more to help with nutrition. You know, I had a bill that looks at ways to, you know, encourage, you know, healthy diets, fresh fruits and vegetables, because that helps lead come out of the bloodstream. There are long-term concerns about this, and I know the state and the federal government are working on those. So you're right, it's not over by any stretch for the families who are suffering. What we can do today, though, is help with the funding for infrastructure to get us back on a track where they have clean water in Flint.
Republican John Molinar represents Michigan's 4th Congressional District. Congressman, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Picture the starting line at a foot race. In one lane, you've got the auto companies and their suppliers. In the other lane, Silicon Valley heavyweights, enterprising startups. And at the finish line, who gets the big momentum, the money, and the future of the mobility business, ride-sharing and self-driving vehicles? That's what's going on today at the Western Detroit Metropolitan Airport. It's the World Mobility Leadership Forum. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is there right now. Daniel, who all's there, and what's the goal of this forum?
I think the goal of this forum is to kind of talk about what's really coming and to get alignment between a lot of the groups you just mentioned. I think there's a lot of consensus that nobody has got the resources and the technology and the global reach to do this by themselves. And they're going to have to be partnering up, and we're already seeing a lot of that partnering going on. Fiat Chrysler with Google, General Motors with Lyft and Cruise Automation. Ford is doing a little bit more on their own, but they continue to move forward. In fact, they announced this morning that they have named a 3M executive as their new CEO of the Ford Smart Mobility LLC unit that they just started.
So it's big, and it's realizing that neither side can go it alone. They do need each other to recognize, to realize what you call this mobility gold rush.
listen, the auto industry as we know it globally is about a $2.5 to $3 trillion business annually. Estimates are that transportation services business could be upwards of $10 trillion, and that $5 to $6 trillion of that will change from one group of stakeholders to another, meaning there will be winners and there will be losers in this whole thing. I think clearly what you see is Silicon Valley and the auto industry recognize this, and they are in a race. And I think it's an apt metaphor. But the things they're talking about here about what could be happening to the world as we know it, particularly in large cities in the United States and around the world, within the next 5 years are remarkable.
Give us an idea. What are you hearing?
Well, for one thing, they're saying that by 2025, so that's 9 years from now, car ownership, private car ownership in big cities may be a thing of the past. And one of the things they're talking about is the possibility that a ride-sharing company, the entire model as we know it flips, meaning we don't own the car, we don't pay for the insurance, we don't pay for the maintenance, we don't pay for parking, we don't pay for storage, we don't pay for cleaning, they pay for it all. They acquire the fleet, they do all that, and then you have an app on your phone, and whenever you need a ride to the grocery store, to work, to the gym, you go onto your phone, you get a car, it picks you up, and so there you wipe out this, probably for a lot of people, the second largest monthly expense that you might have in your household budget. And the impact on disposable income could be dramatic. And in part, if they get down the road, they're saying a lot of these electric vehicles and the impact on emissions, clean air, the use of fossil fuels and oil will change dramatically.
You know, when you describe it that way, I also think it's going to be a great boon to the aging baby boomers as the question comes, do we take mom or dad's keys away? If this is in place, there's the answer.
That's exactly, you put your finger on it. And also for the poor who maybe are living in areas of certain cities that they don't have good access to public transportation, a walk to the bus line or to the subway is too far. This could be a possibility where there could be greater access. The other thing that we heard yesterday that I thought was fascinating was from a guy from Dubai that has the largest ride-sharing company in the Middle East. And essentially what he said is, you know, we don't really have public transportation in a lot of these countries. And so what we think is going to happen is we're going to essentially use ride sharing to leapfrog public transportation to the point where if you're a bus maker or if you're a railroad car maker, you're not going to see business in the Middle East because they're not going to be spending those huge amounts of money to build these systems because they're going to be able to serve the needs of the community with ride sharing. It's really fascinating. And I think the traditionalists listening to us who say, oh, this is never going to happen and I'm never going to give up my keys, you may not have to give up your keys. But I do think it's going to happen, and it's going to happen in some ways. And it's happening very quickly right now.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel House checking in from the World Mobility Leadership Forum at Detroit Metropolitan Airport. As always, Daniel, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And finally, happy Galactic Tick Day. I bet you didn't know that this is Galactic Tick Day, which leads to the question, what is a galactic tick? David Snyder is the inventor of Galactic Tick Day. He's with us now. You're not an astronomer, but can you tell us just what is a galactic tick?
Yeah, Cynthia, thank you for the opportunity to talk about this. So a galactic tick is a unit of time that was essentially invented to take the motion of the solar system around the galaxy, which takes about 225 to 240 million years. And so the idea in creating a holiday to celebrate this motion, we had to figure out how do we take that long period of time and distill it down into something that's a bit more digestible on the human time frame.
Something we can wrap our brains around.
Exactly. A galactic tick is 1/100th of an arc second, as in degrees, minutes, and seconds of that kind of cosmic year.
Okay, so how often do we have a galactic tick happen?
Approximately every 1.77 years. And so the second problem to solve in kind of this idea, and we can get into a little bit about where it comes from if you like, but this idea of having this holiday to celebrate the motion of the solar system around the galaxy was, once we had the length of a tick established, how do we figure out what the starting date should be? And so what we did is took the day that the telescope was patented and essentially extrapolated it out, adding 1.77 years, 1.77 years, and so on and so forth. And so The next galactic tick day is today, and then in another approximately 1.77 years, we'll celebrate again.
Now, why should we care about a galactic tick? Why should we celebrate?
Yeah, I mean, it sounds silly on the surface, and, you know, I can certainly understand that. The rationale behind wanting to do a project like this is, I think it kind of distills down into three buckets. The first is probably the most obvious, which is it's a nice learning opportunity for people to say, hey, you know, the sun is actually in motion. There's large astronomical motions out there, and they're utterly fascinating. The second piece is kind of an appreciation or a settling into the awe of how phenomenal and fantastic that we're alive and awake in a time that there's this endeavor of science going on, and there's been a thoughtfulness that has occurred where people are able to figure this out, and we have the ability to know this information. And then the third level gets like in kind of to the meta or meditative sphere, which is when you're sitting with the size and the scale of existence in, you know, in a quiet time, what arises in your own individual experience? Some people find it crushingly depressing. However, the other side of the spectrum is people think about this and they see kind of Carl Sagan's vision of the pale blue dot and really understand that we are a kind of all in this together as a planetary society. And we know that we're also a human family here.
You know, it's kind of funny because I get that feeling when I follow the International Space Station astronauts on Twitter, and every time they post some photo from up there, I know what you're getting at there. What are you going to do to celebrate Galactic Tick Day?
Yeah, so this evening here in San Francisco, a couple friends and I are hosting a party there. It should be a lot of fun. We've got some science talks and some DJs. There's no recipe for celebrating at this point. Perhaps that will be something that emerges on as we continue to kind of talk about this this idea of Galactic Tick Day and this new fun project here.
And you know what? You don't have to buy presents for Galactic Tick Day. You can just make the most of it.
Yeah, exactly. It's been pretty incredible, the kind of the response. There's a group in Romania, there's a group in Ottawa, and there's a group in Washington, D.C. that I know of, potentially others, that are today gathering together and either having some kind of event or having some kind of science salon or just walking through the park and kind of looking at the stars. So it's something that people have found really interesting, and I kind of like it because it's both silly and extremely deep at the same time.
Indeed. And if we serve this up for everybody a little bit too late to plot any way of celebrating this year's Galactic Tick Day, then, hey, make your plans for 633.7 days down the road and you can do it again. You can actually get more information by going to galactictick.com. That's galactictick.com. David Snyder, inventor of Galactic Tick Day. Thanks, David.
Thank you so much. Have a great GTD.
Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Cass Adair, Allie Billings, Melissa Benmark, Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.